G'day team, welcome to another instalment of the U Project for the, I think this is going to be 553rd time. Hi, Tiff.
Hello, Harps. How are you?
Good, thank you. I have just a sense of deja vu.
Me too.
I don't know, this moment feels somewhat familiar. Do you want to tell people why?
Well, a raging storm rolled through Elizabeth's hometown when we were trying to record yesterday. So our internet was a little bit terrible.
So this is take two. This is take two of our conversation with Elizabeth Lesser. So thank you for turning up again. Thank you for enduring me and Tiff 2 days in a row. You are very brave.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I was so upset yesterday when we had to abort. But as Tiff said, a hurricane slammed into New York City, where I live close to. And I think that's why we had internet problems. Fingers crossed we make it to the end. Otherwise, we'll have to do this again tomorrow and for the rest of our life.
That's right. It'll be a Groundhog Day experience. Yeah. And hopefully we just get better and better. No, let's hope. Let's hope that doesn't have to be the case for you. It's a very seemingly apocalyptic time that we're living in, Elizabeth. Yeah. Like, how does this, I mean, do you have a sense of what's going on in the, I'm sure you do, but what is your sense of right now with the pandemic? With, you were saying before we went live a few minutes ago, in fact, why don't you tell people what happened in New York City yesterday?
Well, a climate change induced hurricane. We've been getting so many of them here in the States, intense storms, lots of rain in parts of the States and other parts, extreme drought and fires. It's very apocalyptic. We got slammed with a rain event where, I don't know, I think now up to 35 people have died in the city, trapped in their basement apartments as the water flew came roaring in. So anyway, yeah, we're living in wild times. It's not as if the earth hasn't had other wild times. Just talk to the dinosaurs. And if you can, I mean, this is where we find ourselves here in the land of duality. There's times of great construction and innovation and peace. And then there are times of difficulty and breakdown. And that happens in our bodies and it happens in our world. And we're in a difficult time now, for sure.
I wonder if it's interesting, isn't it? Because we live in the moment, you know, well, not that we're always present or in the moment, but for the most part, we're here in 2021. And I think because in the context of our own lives, a lot of us don't think, and I know for a lot of my life, I didn't think about the totality of the human timeline, or, you know, the evolution of us. But you think, as you referred to the dinosaurs who came to arguably a cataclysmic end with some kind of asteroidal impact or something, do you ever think about what will happen to humanity and how it will go for us over the coming centuries and millennia, should we live that long?
Oh, I think about it about 50 times a day.
Okay. So good.
I just have one of those psyches where I've been thinking like that since I was about 5 years old. So it's a curse and it's a blessing, because I tend to not personalize what's going on, because I feel part of a long continuum of creation and destruction and creation and destruction on the most tiny cellular level within our own bodies. You know how the biologists say your body next year will be almost a new body. Mm. Your organs, different organs turn over, some within a week, some with a year. Our cells are constantly dying, being reborn. Mm. I became very aware of this a few years ago when I was my sister's bone marrow donor. She was dying from cancer and she would only live if she got a bone marrow transplant. Wow. And I was the one person in the family who tested as her match. And I did a lot of research into what is bone marrow anyway, and what is a stem cell transplant? What the heck am I getting myself into here? And it was just so fascinating, the biology that's going on under our skin that we don't think about. We don't think about the timeline of humanity, and we don't think about what's going on in our body. This amazing orchestration of creation and destruction every minute in our cells.
Yes.
So I think I find peace in the fact that what we're going through right now as a human community is not new. This is the game we signed on to in this incarnation. It's one of creation, destruction, the leaves falling off the trees, creating the compost so the seed can sprout and the new plant can come. This is what happens, but it's so hard for our little fearful egos, my own included, to accept that. Like big news, you're born and you die. But we just can't. We can't wrap our heads and hearts around it.
Isn't it so interesting that, like, ultimately, I mean, of course, there's a lot of stuff in between the being born and the dying bit. There's a few peaks and troughs and stories and, you know, joy and pain and heartbreak and love and all that stuff in between. But ultimately, that's the human experience. And, you know, what happens after we die, you know better than I do, I'm sure. And we'll talk about that. But why do you think that we tend not to, and I'm generalizing here, so if you're listening and this is not you, please don't be offended, I'm generalizing, but why do you think we have a very insular, us-focused perspective? We don't tend to often have an awareness bigger than ourselves. Like, we don't think about, you know, it's like the 7.9 billion people on the planet, like literally metaphorically, I'm a grain of sand in a enormous desert of humanity. I'm important, but really I'm kind of nothing, and I'm okay with being nothing. Is it worth our while to open the door to a consciousness and an awareness bigger than ourselves, or does our ego and our fragile self-esteem not want that?
Well, I think our ego and fragile self-esteem is mistaken. It thinks that if I'm not the center of the universe, if I'm not special, if I don't prevail, if I can't dominate this scene here, it's either or. Either I'm the special one and everyone else isn't, or life will just have no meaning for me and I won't be able to deal with it. That's a misconception. It is so liberating and joy producing and creativity stimulating to take yourself out of the center of the universe and to be one of the marvelous creations. It's not like if you're not special, then you're nothing and life has no meaning. Mm. It's like we are each a tiny piece in a tapestry. Mm. And we need each other, we support each other, we are each other. I can't really tell you what that really means, but I know that I feel happier, more creative, healthier, in better relationship if I actually do stop thinking I'm so special. And I don't mean that like, therefore I'm a good and saintly person. I just mean it really works.
Yeah.
It is a relationship magic.
Yes.
To tame our nutty egos and to get them tamed at least part of the day so we can wake up to the magnificence of everyone and everything.
How do we become aware of the stuff that lives beyond our own programming and thinking and beliefs and values and an ideology, not necessarily so that becomes our new ideology or value system, but just opening, that's a bad question. Let me ask a better question. Why do we live in the echo chamber? Why do so many of us feel uncomfortable to be wrong or to not know? Why do we need to be right?
Well, there's lots of answers to that question.
That was a 20-part question, so take your time. Well, I apologize.
And there's 20 parts to the answer. Because first of all, that's the biggest question ever. And if I could say, oh, here they are, number one, there's five answers. Number one, but there, it's like people have been writing books and creating religions forever trying to answer that question. Like, why, if we know that our ego striving and our us and them mentality makes us so unhappy and turns us into warring assholes, why are we locked in it? This is the big philosophical question. And there's people have come up with beautiful tools about how you might relax the grip that our egos have on us, the fear grip and the special grip. There's lots of beautiful tools. Those are good to talk about. The why of it, you know, some people who are more psychologically oriented would say, because as a baby, you were not seen, you were not loved adequately, and you didn't attach well, and therefore you're going to spend the rest of your life, you know, hey, look at me, look at me.
Yeah.
There's that, there's the psychological. Then there's the spiritual, which is we're separated from God here, isolated in our little egos, our little human bodies, and it's painful, and we want to reconnect, and we don't know how. And there's all sorts of philosophical, psychological, spiritual answers. I don't know. I'm a little more interested in, it's a good question, obviously, but I'm more interested in, how can I get out of my echo chamber for the sake of my own happiness and health and the people around me? Because we hurt each other so much because of our firm identification as just little me.
Yeah. I think part of getting out of my echo chamber is realizing that the only person who thinks like me, as in all the time, the only person who's looking through my window at the world is me. You know, that this is just my story about reality. You know, this is my personal self-created reality. And I think, I don't know, like I feel like, Elizabeth, the people that I've spoken to over, you know, I'm 57. I started working with people one-on-one when I was 18 years old on the gym floor when people would come and go, I want to be fitter, leaner, lighter. So I was having conversations with grown-ups about their, you know, their bum and their legs and their carbs and their protein and their emotional issues and their marriage and their self-esteem and their body image and all that 39 years ago. And one thing that I, or a couple of things that I've realized is that people don't like uncertainty and they don't like familiarity and they don't like discomfort and they don't like not knowing. They want to know. And the older I get and the more, like you said just then, I don't know. But I love that. I love that you go, I don't know. Because so many people who are leaders or teachers or coaches or whatever, guides or experts or whatever we want to, whatever label we want to give them, so often feel compelled to know. And there's so much stuff that I don't know, but I'm curious about.
Listen, if somebody really knew the answers to the biggies, you know, where do we come from? Where do we go when we die?
Yeah.
How do we love? How do we share limited resources? What does good power look like? How do we lead? If somebody had the exact answers in this consumer society we live in, we would have bought them. Every single one of us would have bought them. It would be over. We don't know. And that's why, to me, my first spiritual practice of every day, and I repeat it over and over, is a little line I say to myself, relax into the mystery. Just relax into it. You can't solve it. These are not solved. Our human brains are very crude divining rods into the mystery of the universe.
Yeah.
They're limited. We have limited brains. There's way more to know than we are capable of knowing. It's okay. It's like, I am not going to waste all my energy trying to figure something out. That's ineffable. That's a mystery. So a big part of meditation for me is relaxing that I love curiosity. I'll always be curious, but relaxing this need to know what's coming next and to think you're going to have the answers or that someone else has the answers. That's also a problem. Mm. When we look to other people for the answers, and then we turn them into graven images, you know, the guru, the teacher, the priest, the holy yes. woman.
Yes.
They're struggling too.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to somebody on a podcast recently, and we were talking about, this is kind of seems unrelated, but it is. We were talking about speaking about knowledge and certainty, and somebody asked me a question about exercise programming, writing programs for people, or giving people diets or giving people information that will help them create the outcome they want to create with their body. And I said, you've got to remember that even someone like me who's prescribed tens of thousands of exercise programs, is an exercise scientist, has owned multiple gyms, all that stuff. Even when I give somebody a program, which I don't do anymore these days, but if I give someone a program, it's still me guessing. It's still me taking my best guess at what the outcome will be, because virtually everything is uncertain. I wanted to ask you, what is God to you? Not what is God, but what is God, or who or what is God to you? I thought we'd just start with the easy ones and we'll build up to the hard ones. No pressure.
God is, God, first of all, God is a mystery.
Mm.
And I feel God. I don't think God. Right. I experience the emotion of illumination. I feel it's a heart connection for me. It's not a mental process. It's not a dogma. And if someone asks me to prove it, I can't. It's like love. What is love?
Yes.
It's something that God is everything and God is nothing, and I am in relationship with God. I am God. There's really bad. These are not good words. That's why the poets say it best. And Jesus was a poet. Mm. And the Psalms in the Old Testament are poetry. And the Quran is a poem, because we're all just... it's conjecture.
Mm. And also we're talking also about, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, we have absolute knowledge. Like we know that gravity is real because we can see it in action. We know that I can see that there's 20 trees outside my window. I've got evidence, I've got proof, I've got science, but.
Except you really don't, because as you said, it's your perception.
Yes.
It's your story. So you are perceiving something through a body, and that electrical impulses are bouncing off of, and then you're telling your story about it. This is a tree. I yes. like trees.
Yeah.
So there, this whole idea that science proves, spirituality doesn't, I'm sorry, it's all stories, and the best stories humans can tell about this puzzling reality we find ourselves in.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true. I mean, even I was talking yesterday to Melissa, who is does the podcast with me as well as Tiff, some of the shows, and runs my life. We're talking about color, and I was watching the way that we perceive color in our world, and I was listening to a a neuroscientist talk about the fact that there are no colors in the world. All the colors are produced by our brain, which is why two people looking at the same color in inverted commas see different colors. And then if you bring a dog into the picture, he or she sees something completely different, and then another animal something different. And then, you know, and the fact is we're all looking at the same thing, but we're all seeing a different thing, because that thing that we think we're seeing, and you explain it beautifully, I think I'm looking at a tree. Well, I just grew up with that image and being told that that's what a tree is. And so there is this constant production of reality in our mind and in our emotions that we're unaware of, because I don't know who it was originally, it's been flogged, but Anais Nin was a writer who used it. I think it was also used in maybe some of the older Jewish teachings, was we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are.
Yeah. And Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, said, if our senses were fine enough, we would see the slumbering cliff as a dancing chaos. Because everything, the chair you're sitting in, your hand, your glasses, my glasses, they are spinning molecules. They aren't really anything. They're just held together temporarily. We call them glasses. They feel like they're made of something, but everything is really just molecular, atomic. And so when I say relax into the mystery, what I mean is let go, like that Anais Nin quote, let go of the story we have at least a couple of times a day. If we had lived constantly in a world where the cliff was a dancing chaos, you'd probably walk into traffic and get run over.
Yes.
So you have to have sense, you have to have an ego. It's not like get rid of that stuff, but every now and then, especially if you feel yourself being super snarky and judgmental and assholey, like just kind of like, ooh, that person is a bunch of dancing molecules and so am I, and we have no idea what's going on here. Perhaps we could relax and enjoy ourselves. It's wild.
Yeah. And what about this person and I have different beliefs and different insights and different, maybe even different values, but I'm going to love them anyway. What about that?
Yeah. That would be great.
You know, that different like religion. Recipe. You know, what I find ironic is that most religious texts are, you know, at the core on some level, most have, you know, love as a fundamental kind of platform for the teachings. But there's in the actual theology, but in the reality of the religion on a human level, there's so much hate. It's like, such a conflict. There's such a contradiction.
It's such a
contradiction, isn't it? So, all right. So what we learned was, now I'm not going to drag you through the same stories as you gave us yesterday. So I'm going to give the snapshot. Then I want to ask. So yesterday you told us, by the way, if you're just kind of figuring out where we're going, yesterday, Tiff and Elizabeth and I recorded half an episode, but we had internet issues. So we're rebooting. So and we appreciate you very much. So yesterday, I think you told me that one of your parents was Jewish and one was a Christian Scientist, but it was a bit breaky-uppy. Did I get that right?
You did, yeah. Yes.
And they came out of that with, certain experiences that led them to become atheists and raise you in that, mindset or paradigm or whatever we want to call it. But you yourself were very curious about all things, and you started opening that, or you started exploring and thinking and wondering. I think you said when you're in your kind of early teens. I wanted to ask you, which I didn't yesterday, how did mum and dad respond with your spiritual curiosity?
Well, and my three sisters, because I was the weirdo.
What made you weird?
Well, I wanted to go to church with my next door neighbor who was Catholic, or I wanted to get, you know, go to synagogue or anything. I just wanted something. I just wanted to be in a community with people talking about the big stuff.
Yeah.
And So I remember once when I was probably about 12 or 13 coming home from Ash Wednesday. I went to church with my next door neighbors and got that smudge on my forehead.
Yeah.
And to me, it was the most spiritually romantic thing, you know, like the whole idea of Catholicism. I was so upset when I found out I couldn't take communion, or I couldn't tell all of my deep, dark secrets to the priest behind the dark curtain. Like, I just wanted to do all that so badly. And I came home one day from getting the smudge on my forehead on Ash Wednesday, and my family just fell on the ground laughing hysterically. They just thought I was just like so odd and so weird. You know, they didn't, my parents didn't like punish me or tell me never to do it. They were just mystified that they had worked so hard themselves not to have to go to church and to renounce religion and to take up more like intellectual pursuits. They were just mystified that a child of theirs would like regress. In their mind, it was a massive regression into the opiate of the masses.
Oh, I love that. The opiate of the masses. And your siblings didn't go down the same route or have the same interest?
Eventually, one of them did.
Right.
But you know how a lot of people come to self-inquiry and looking at the deeper questions when something goes terribly wrong in their life. Mm. So one of my sisters, when her marriage broke up, she was like, oh, that's what you've been up to all these years, you know, trying to find some way through the dark times.
Yeah, yeah. And did a light bulb come on for her?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember about 18 months ago, Elizabeth, I was training with my training partner, who is otherwise healthy, fit, doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, despite what I'm about to tell you, no heart issues. Anyway, he had a cardiac arrest when we were training. So died, flatlined, dead.
Wow. And,
yeah, dead, in the gym, dead. Blue whole shooting match. It's all right, it ends well. But it's funny how, not funny, but it's interesting how moments in time can influence us greatly, you know, for better or worse. And it's funny how in that moment, funny is probably the wrong word, interesting, curious, like he was dead for 17 minutes. And those 17 minutes, I could pretty much describe each second of the 17 minutes in some detail. And the first 11 minutes when I was working on him before the Ambos got there, I could describe that. I could spend an hour on each minute, right? But it's also interesting how at the door of death, right, at the door, like in the middle of a death experience for someone else, or I don't know if that's the right term, I'm probably stuffing that up, but in the middle of that, how, and I know we talk about this, but how nothing matters, like absolutely nothing matters except living and except loving and except. And I remember having some deep conversations with God in those 17 minutes going, all right, I know I've got some redeeming to do. And it's just funny how there's nothing, like there's almost nothing intellectual going on in my brain. Like, you know, other than salt.
When you asked me, who is God? And I stumbled around with words.
Yeah.
It's like in that moment when you were so present and so alive and so not running your usual mind, crazy obsessions, fears, conversations, contradictions, comparisons, like, and it went away. You suddenly, you didn't have to describe who was God. You were in relationship, life and God. And apparently it's not practical for us to live like that all the time. But we rely on those moments to remind us that we're walking around like zombies most of the time, not aware of the remarkable situation we are living in every moment.
Mm. Yeah. And it's just that it's so true. It's that we're kind of, it sounds offensive. I don't mean it to, because I think I've spent a lot of my life in a similar place, whereas we're kind of almost in Groundhog Day, you know, emotionally, psychologically, sociologically, behaviorally, habitually, like we're doing things that don't work. Mm-hmm. And by work, I mean, we're doing things that actually don't serve us or empower us or are not optimal for us or don't improve our mental or emotional health or our physical health or our spiritual health or our relationships. But nonetheless, we just keep doing what didn't work yesterday. We get up and do the thing that didn't really work well yesterday. We do it again today, and boom, now I'm 50 and now I'm 55 and now it's 2026. And I'm still in Groundhog Day and I'm still telling myself the same stories and I'm still rationalizing why I'm not doing those things. Do you think,
Well, one way that when I realized that about myself and everyone around me, one way that really helps me is I put my hand on my heart and kind of go like pat it and feel tender toward myself and my fellow human creatures. It's like, oh, it's okay. This is the way we were built. It's all right. You're not some sort of unique failure here. This is what we're all doing. So I try to flush myself with a sense of tenderness instead of like this, you better get it together. You know, I can't believe it. It's 2026 and you're still like this. You know, more just like, it's okay. We're all so silly. It's okay. And that allows me to put the shame down and to sort of step more lightly and gracefully into a higher consciousness.
So that new workshop of yours called Get Your Shit Together, that's not coming out anytime soon?
No. I don't teach that anymore.
Yeah, no. Well, it's good that you saw the light, you know, and you put that on the old shelf. So now, of course, everyone will read this in the bio, but so some of your books, let me just go. So Broken Open, How Difficult Times Can Help Us Grow, The Seeker's Guide, Making Your Life a Spiritual Adventure, Marrow, A Love Story, Cassandra Speaks, the most recent one, I think, When Women Are the Storytellers, The Story Changes. And I think the first one, which was in 1999, maybe The New American Spirituality. So you've written lots of stuff. And also you co-founded about 30 years ago, I think you said yesterday, the Omega Institute, which is the largest adult education center focused on health, wellness, spirituality, and creativity. How did that come about? How did the 15-year-old atheist, 13-year-old atheist who was curious and weird, clearly weird, who got ash on her forehead in some weird Catholic ritual, end up opening the Omega Institute? What was part of the journey and the catalyst for that? And what is it?
Well, Omega Institute at the moment, because of all of the lockdowns around COVID, for the first time in 40 years, we have had to shut down. But for the past 40 years, we have been a conference and retreat center that welcomes about 20 to 30,000 people every year to do workshops in everything from exercise and health and diet to lots of different spiritual retreats, coaching, psychological healing. We do quite a bit of work with bringing things like meditation and yoga to groups that don't usually get it. We do retreats for veterans of war, and we bring stuff into prisons and things like that. This feeling that like healing work should not just be for those who can afford it or are naturally inclined to seek it. So we've evolved a lot over the years. When we started, we were just a bunch of young kids with an idea, and it quickly became way bigger than we ever thought it would. But how did I come to start it? I think I started telling you this yesterday, that there I was, this weird little atheist kid, and with this longing for some kind of community that might answer some of these deep questions. And that was about the same time in America in the late 70s, 80s, all these gurus were washing up on the shores of America. And I like, oh yeah, that's what I want. Mm. That Eastern spirituality. Oh, that's even better than getting ashes on my forehead on Wednesday, you know? So I started enjoying meditation classes and yoga. And it was very strange at that time. Now in Australia and America, like every other block has a yoga studio and things. But then it was very strange and on the fringes of American culture. Mm. But it very much spoke to me. So we started offering, my ex-husband and I, and he was a medical doctor, we started, and he was very interested in alternative health, which was also very odd at the time, how food could be medicine, yeah. How Eastern techniques like acupuncture actually might be good incorporated with Western techniques, things that today are like, yeah, what's new, but it was new then.
Yeah.
So we started this very tiny conference center that grew very big, very fast. Mm,
mm. Wow. When you were growing up, when you were that weird teenager, and even before that, I don't know if you have clarity around this, because I'm not even sure what I wanted to be, but what did you, in inverted commas, want to be or do? Did you have an idea of what grown up you would look like when you were a kid?
Yeah, I wanted to be a writer.
Oh, wow. Well, you're doing that.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to be, a writer.
Do you think as a communicator, I've written a few books as well, but my job is speaking primarily. Do you think you connect more with people, you personally, through books or through presenting? Or is it just different?
Definitely through books. Yeah. I always say I'm an introvert who knows how to be an extrovert,
right.
But my happy place is all alone in my writing room, writing.
Yeah.
Easing out the words that might be able to be wrapped around these concepts. I just, to say I love it is sort of a lie, because writing is really hard and sometimes I hate it. Mm. But I'm most effective on the written word. I like speaking and I love being with people, but I for me, it's writing.
Yeah. Does being with people sometimes for you, although you love people and you love connecting with people, but is it for you sometimes exhausting?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. You know, I've been sort of the wind beneath the sails for many, many speakers and teachers. I've helped a lot of people take their books and turn them into curriculum. And I've given, you know, this has been my work at Omega. And for a while I thought, well, I should teach too.
Mm.
And my problem with it is I want to fix everybody. Like people's suffering touches me so deeply that I lose touch with, you know, taking a step back and just speaking. I want to get in there and fix everybody, which is a recipe for not working, you know, that you need some distance as a good teacher and speaker. And I'm not very good at that.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges when you're in you're a person like you who loves people so much and cares, and when someone's hurting, you're hurting, but at the same time, you're in charge of this organization and you've got kids and is that the last person that you really take care of is you? And like a lot of the stuff that I do when I'm talking with teams or companies these days is I don't actually talk about business or the bottom line. I talk about self-management and with the idea about, firstly, how do I manage me? Not in a selfish way or an egoic way, but how do I manage my mind, body, emotions, energy, choices, time, resources, so that I can be, I hate this cheesy term, but I can be the best version of me for everyone else. Because if I'm 3 out of 10 physically and 4 out of 10 emotionally and 2 out of 10 mentally and 2 out of 10 spiritually, I can't show up and do what's required at any kind of good level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So what is your self-care, self-management program, if at all? Like, do you need to get, like I was telling Tip before we went live, I was asleep at 9 o'clock last night and got up at 6:30, and my body is just loving the shit out of me right now.
Yeah. Yep. Sleep, really important for me. I do not do well with less than 8 hours. I've always wanted to be the kind of person who needed like 4 hours of sleep, but I'm not. I'm very, you know, my body, even though we agreed a little while ago that our bodies are just moving atoms and molecules and are held together by gravity, still my body is my temple here on Earth. And that took me a long time. It took me a long time to really fall in love with my own body. I think it may be a little harder for women. I don't know if that's true. So many expectations on women that it's what you look like as opposed to how you feel on the inside. So for so long, what I thought taking care of my body was presenting it as a beautiful sexualized object in the world. That's just what I thought it was. I'm not saying anybody was like abusing me or making me do that, but that was the cultural expectation. And it took me a while to understand that if I could just fall in love with my body in whatever state it was in at the moment, you know, it wasn't about, oh, but my hair is bad and my skin is broken out and I'm a little overweight. You know, like, no, love it now. The way like we take care of our children because we love them.
Yes.
We take care of our dog because we love it. If you can love your body first, then you're going to want to take care of it. So it took me a while to get that idea that love this chariot that you have been given to ride through life. Just love it. And then you may want to take care of it better. And that was a big switch for me. It kind of happened in my 30s. And that's when I began to really take care of myself better. Do you understand what I mean by that?
100%. And I think also, I mean, for better or worse, one of the things that I've had, I think it's a blessing to do over the however many years, Elizabeth, is work with people whose bodies are legitimately broken. I mean, badly broken, you know, very injured, very sick, very unwell, very incapacitated people, right through to the other end of the scale with elite athletes with perfect genetics and extreme fitness. But one of the blessings for me, or one of the light bulbs for me, and I grew up, I was a morbidly obese kid. I was the fattest kid in my school. My name at school was Jumbo. I hated my body. I hated how I looked. I got picked last for every sporting team, all those things, right? So no issues at all, Elizabeth, none. And not one. No, what are you looking at? But what was great for me, what has been great for me is the working with people who, for them to get out of a chair and to walk to the door, which is 10 feet away, is like a fucking Olympic gold medal. I'm like, you are a superstar. And so when I can get out of a chair and I can walk, put on the kettle, make a cup of tea, walk upstairs to my office, walk around the block, do a few push-ups, you know, I go, my body's awesome and I'm grateful. You know, so I think there's, when you're younger, I'm generalizing, but again, worked with lots of bodies and people, it tends to be, I always talk about look, feel, function, performance. And so how I look, how I feel, how I function and how I perform, which is more slanted towards athletic stuff. But when we're younger, we're mostly about how we look. And the older that we get, it tends to be a more about how we feel and how we function. And you know, when you, I think gratitude comes from people, from being around people who are doing it way, way worse than we are. And you go, oh yeah, that's right. I can see, I can see. I can turn on a tap and there's cold. I can push that button and there's light. I can walk out and get in my car and go to the supermarket and not going to get shot on the way or blown up. I don't live in a war-torn country. You know, for me, it's all the stuff that isn't happening to me that gives me gratitude.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
You know, and I think it's good to have that. Now, I know we're going to wind up in a minute, so just quickly, and I know you don't like banging on about all this stuff, but we do. So you work with some really high profile people because you're a superstar. I'm disappointed you don't wear a caftan, but work on that. Ram Dass, the Dalai Lama, Oprah, Deepak, all these cool people, but not only the high profile superstar-y people, but you've interacted and connected with, you know, tens of thousands of people over your journey. Who are some of the people that, superstar or not, could be your third cousin, have influenced you?
Well, all those people you named, Ram Dass especially, was an extremely important person in my life. You know, I met him when I was very young. And my relationship with him was kind of fascinating because I was always organizing his retreats at Omega, and he was someone who refused to be organized. Huh. So I was always fighting with him, like arguing with him and saying things like, "Yes, I know the meditation is going very well now, but lunch is served. And if we don't eat it now, then dinner won't be served." And so I was always, this was often my relationship with a lot of the teachers. I was just having to like keep them in reality.
Yes.
Which was a wonderful way to interact with people who didn't really appreciate reality all that much, or a different kind of reality. My work with Oprah has been so foundational to my own stepping into my sense of self and my own power, because she was incredibly empowering to me. Mm. I helped her produce a lot of things, and I had my own radio show on her network. And she was the kind of leader and colleague and boss who just handed stuff over with a lot of trust. Mm. And that really has helped me in my own leadership, the way she was with me. It is the way I try to be with the people who work for me. You know, some of the teachers I really enjoy right now, you know, I've been at this for so many years, but like, I love the work of Eckhart Tolle. I love his books. I love him as a teacher. I think I could count on my hand, one hand, the teachers who to me like actually live what they teach. Oh dear.
That's all right. Do you want to grab that?
No, I don't. But it's going to take three more rings to go off so we can just meditate.
If I reckon we should leave that in because it's hilarious.
So actually it was my grandson calling. I'm his best friend.
How old is your grandson?
That one is 8. I got a bunch of them.
That's hilarious.
I got a gaggle of grandkids. I had my first kid when I was 22. So oh, wow. I have grandkids when I'm still able to, like, what I do with that one and his brother is we sumo wrestle together. And I told him the other day, I am the only grandmother in the world who sumo wrestles, okay?
Are you, though? Have you got one of those giant nappies, though?
So, I love Eckhart Tolle's work. I love Pema Chodron's work. She's a Buddhist nun. And, you know, I love the person who bags my groceries and my gym trainer and someone I've never met, and I love you and Tiff. And I really, I mean this. I find inspiration from everybody.
I love
sometimes
that.
The most popular people are just people who have really fantastic skills to impart information. It doesn't mean they have any more information or wisdom than you do. They're skilled at imparting it. It's really good to remember that, because creating the separation between yourself and a spiritual teacher is the ultimate contradiction.
Yeah.
The teacher always says, it's in you. It's within you. And then we make the teacher be the one who has it, even though the teacher is saying, it's within you. So take that seriously. It is within you.
Isn't it interesting that I call this the duality of the human experience. Other people call it different things, and that term gets used a bit. But for me, when I talk to people about self-management, we talk about the physical, three-dimensional, external world, you know, of jobs and cars and other humans and traffic and government and trees, whether or not they're real, Elizabeth. and then the internal world of thoughts and feelings and emotions and values and love and passion and excitement and creativity and spontaneity and joy. And, you know, that because we are physical beings or spiritual beings, perhaps having a physical experience for whatever, 70 or 80 or 90 years, you know, but we've still got this coexistence that we need to navigate, you know, because we're not just a spirit and we're not just a body and we're not just a mind and we're not just a grandma, you know, and we're not just a teacher and we're not just a business owner. We're so many things. And the challenge for me, and I think maybe lots of people similar, is that, you know, in this opening the door and the studying and the being still and the opening up and the trying to get over my mind, trying to get my mind out of the way of what is, because my mind is, there's an expression that we have in Australia. I think I'm going to shock you, Elizabeth, but can I say it, Tiff, or not?
Of course you can.
Yeah.
Of course you can.
My mind is like a dog with three dicks, Elizabeth. Now, don't think about that too much. It's busy, right?
I am not going to think about that.
No, you don't think about that at all. You're far too spiritually evolved to think about
things. No, there's no vaginas involved.
Like, no, I don't want to drag you down to my very base level. And all of my very spiritual listeners now who love you and have read all your books and think you're awesome, they're going to be shaking their head that I said that. But, you know, this being able to manage the internal stuff in the demands of the external world, it's kind of like ever present, isn't it?
Yes. And it's not going to go away.
Yes.
And we can't get it perfectly.
Yeah.
And the point is to enjoy life. Yeah. That's the point. Yeah. I really think we were put here on this gorgeous, gorgeous planet with so much diversity and lusciousness and beauty and fun. We were put here to experience it and to love it and to enjoy it. And we screw it up so badly. So I think the idea that spiritual practice somehow will make you into like your best self, you know, this rigid idea, It's more like it will help you relax and enjoy what we have and stop thinking you need more, 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 and better, better, better.
Yeah.
That's what Ram Dass always used to say. He always used to just stop and say,
Yeah. Well, we grow up in, most of us anyway, we're going to wind up now, but we grow up in this collective mindset that success is about stuff, you know, and we're taught and told and trained from early, I was anyway, directly or indirectly, that success is about what everyone can see. And sometimes we do all this accumulating and acquiring, and then we kind of wake up in the middle of all of our stuff and go, why am I miserable? Why am I disconnected? And, you know, it one doesn't seem to go with the other. So, Elizabeth, it's been awesome. We appreciate your time so much and your wisdom and your insight and your love. How can people, now I know you're an introvert, But how can people connect with your work or follow you or find you or buy your books? Is there a kind of a general website?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is elizabethlesser.org. And all my Facebook and Instagram and stuff are all there. And my books. There's a lot of good stuff on that website.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you being on the U Project, and go and play with that grandkid of yours.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. I really am happy we got to do it for two days.
Yeah, I know. I feel like we're besties now. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Tiff.
Thank you.